are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, November 7th, 2018. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, national political correspondent for the Washington Post, Dave Weigel, will be here to, well, maybe not totally wrap up the midterm elections. We still have significant amount of results to come in. But at the very least, we can say the Democrats have taken the House with at least 222 members of Congress. That represents 29 flips. There was one on the Republican side. There are still several races not yet called. Meanwhile, Democrats lose in the Senate. Four Democratic seats flip to Republicans. One Republican seat flips to Democrats. Still waiting on at least two off the top of my head. Well, we could easily do that math. Probably closer to three we are waiting on. But that will not implicate the control of the Senate. Meanwhile, Democrats gain seven governorships and flip six state houses across the country. Big, big news there. Big wins and major gains for voting rights in Florida, in Michigan, in Maryland, in Missouri. We're seeing redistricting changes. So voting suppression may have carried the day in a couple of states last night, but institutionally it lost last night. Meanwhile, California says we're okay with that gas tax. And New York finally goes all blue. And down ballot goes fully progressive. Meanwhile, Democrats prepare to issue subpoenas from about more committees than you could probably count on both your hands and feet. Millions to get Medicaid, both via referendum and some changes in state houses. And lastly, the United States Congress now has more women representing Americans ever than at any other time in the history of the country. Additionally, some firsts. We have Native American women congresspeople, Muslim congresspeople, and Democratic Socialists people, and the youngest of all congressional, Congress people now from New York. All this and more on today's program. Let me just start. You know, there was, going into last night's election, there was a, obviously people had a tremendous emotional investment that, and you know, this is, I think this is typical human nature, right? You create expectations, you perceive those expectations are going to be met, and then you develop greater expectations, which really is, I think, essential to human ambition and to human progress. You don't sit on your laurel. You know, a year ago, if somebody had said, oh, the Democrats are going to take back the House, or 2 years ago, some Democrats take back the House, with a 29-vote swing, I think people would have said, okay, great, we'll take it. That's fantastic. But, of course, what happens is you develop more and more ambitious ambitions. And Beto O'Rourke in Texas, a state that has not elected a Democratic Senate or even a Democrat statewide, I think, in over a quarter of a century, people thought has a chance. And he did have a chance, but it was an uphill battle. In Florida, highly unlikely that Andrew Gillum would have been the nominee, never mind winning. It would have been nice if Bill Nelson had left the House a little bit during this campaign. Apparently, couldn't be bothered. That one, I think, you know, we'll talk to Dave Weigel if he has a sense of that race. But Stacey Abrams, also a long shot. If you had said to me a year and a half ago, the next governor of Georgia will be an African-American woman, I would have been like, oh, you're wrong. And it's not over. She may end up going to a runoff. Andrew Gillum, the numbers are down to like 15,000. Last night, late, we got a report from a voter in Florida who said that the new Florida licenses did not scan from the scanners at the election stations, the voting booths, essentially. And so he anticipates there would have been a lot of provisional ballots. We don't know. Is that is a lot 50,000 or is it like 3,000? We just don't know. But assuming for the moment that we have not that Andrew Gillum did not win, we still guys like Scott Walker, bye bye. Chris Kobach, bye bye. Colorado flips. We saw governors in New Mexico, in Maine, Illinois, Michigan. I mean, contemplate what are the states that Donald Trump won that he shouldn't have won to win the election? Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And if you don't think having a Democratic governor in Wisconsin is not worth 11,000 votes in a presidential election, just in terms of resources, I don't think you know much about politics. With all due respect to whoever you are that I just said that to.
Sell out.
Same in Michigan. 7,000 votes. The resources that come from a governorship, never mind the fact that what also passed in Michigan was a wholesale election reform in terms of voting. You get, I think, registration by mail. Let me get the list of stuff here. But, I mean, it's big stuff. Really big reforms for Michigan. And this is a state that has practiced a certain amount of voter suppression as well. We could see things improve in Wisconsin in that way. Let me pull this out here. In Maryland, same-day voter registration passes could bring about 7% of the voting age population in Maryland onto the rolls, according to research. Missouri and Arkansas raised their minimum wages. I can't find all my list of all the things in Michigan, but we'll get there. But significant. Here it is. Automatic voter registration, same-day registration, post-election audits, no excuse absentee voting. You don't have to justify. In New York, you have to be out of county. Straight ticket voting. Protections for military and overseas voters. This is big election reform. And we've seen that across the country. In Florida, 1.5 million people are going to get the opportunity to vote. Andrew Gillum is down by 15 or 10,000 votes. And I don't know. I don't know how many of those people, felons, are going to take the opportunity to vote now that they've got it. And I don't know how many of them are going to vote Democratic, but I would be awful shocked at the end of the day if that number didn't constitute a 10 to 15,000 vote swing. So there's a lot of stuff that happened yesterday that was extremely positive. And not the least of which is the Democrats will have the ability to both investigate Donald Trump and what's going on at these agencies. They will have the ability to slow the roll of any type of legislation, obviously. And in these states, you're going to have the ability to have some measure of control over how redistricting happens and having resources going into 2020. So it would have been great if we were talking about Governor Andrew Gillum right now. It would be great if we were talking about Governor Stacey Abrams or Senator Beto O'Rourke, or frankly, if we were talking about the Democrats controlling the Senate, which I think, you know, fortunately for everyone's emotions, nobody, I think, sort of embraced that in the way that they embraced the possibility of Andrew Gillum and Stacey Abrams and Beto O'Rourke and maybe two-thirds of those three or something to that effect. And the important thing now is that all the new voters who were activated, the tremendous strength exhibited by women in terms of coming out and organizing, that those people who have who've entered into not just voting, but activism around politics, not get discouraged by this. Both because, A, it shouldn't be discouraging, the results. You don't want to go out necessarily and have a party about it, but these results are in no way discouraging. To have lost the House, it is almost unfathomable what a horror show that would have been. Medicare, Social Security, you would have seen cuts definitively, without a doubt. You probably would have seen all of the patient protections in the Affordable Care Act completely gutted. That's just as a starter. I'm sure there would have been other horrors, but those are pretty big ones right there. So we have protected Social Security. We have protected Medicare. And just broadly speaking, we'll also tell you this. We are looking at a much more conservative Republican Party, a much more Trumpista Republican Party, and a more progressive Democratic Party. Those two things are the truth. You lost some of the non-Trumpers, the never-Trumpers. They didn't do much. But maybe you'll hear Mitt Romney come up and say something occasionally.
That wasn't very gracious of the president.
Now, on the Democratic side, for what it's worth, and I'm not sure how much it is worth anything, frankly, but you have a much more progressive caucus, right? Only Joe Manchin at this point is the only conservative left. And so I'm not sure what that's going to mean, frankly, if they will get more obstructionist to the extent that they can. But it is what it is. All right. We're going to take a quick break in a moment, although let's just check in on this. This was a pretty stunning night last night. Our good friend Steve Ducey went to a bar in Missouri because he was out trying to get a feel for you know, the average person. So he goes out to a bar in Missouri, and look at how he connects with the average person. It's really, really touching. When he asked this woman, why is she voting for Claire McCaskill?
Like I've said before, my husband, my son's father, Sean Krause, passed away this summer because he didn't have health care.
Yeah.
And he died because he was poor in America, and it happens more often than people would like to believe.
And that was the number one issue for
number
you.
Number one.
When the Democrats, Brett and Martha, were talking about health care, a couple of the people here at the bar, the Patton Alley Bar, it hit home, and that's why they voted for her. Of course, Josh Hawley's people are waiting for the results just about a mile from where we're standing right now. All right, back to you all in New York.
All right, have fun at the pub.
Have fun at the pub.
Wow.
Can you imagine having someone tell you that their husband died because they didn't have enough money to have health insurance because they were poor in America, and you going, so that's your number one issue.
Not the caravan. Fascinating.
But other people
are worried about other things. Let's go back to New York now.
Right. Let's step over here to the folks who seem to be having a little bit more fun. Wonder why that is. You Democrats sure take this to heart, don't you?
Just trying to have a fun show here.
Leave it on the field.
You know what's amazing, too, is that she started it by saying, as I said. So they clearly had asked her beforehand. So is it like Ducey was like in this moment, like, oh, I don't know how to respond. It's almost as if like he didn't even listen the first time. And by the second time, it almost like just occurs to him like, oh, I probably should show some slight bit of sympathy.
Ah. It was like the this is a pull, but the Harry Shearer disc jockey in Wayne's World. I don't know if you guys remember that, but like they go on the show and they're just insulting him the whole time, and he's just like, "Oh yeah, that's great, super excited about the festival," and they're like, "You're a loser," and he's just like, "Oh wow, so who else is going to be there?" He just has like a completely disconnected response.
So disconnected.
To every single thing. And except in this case, instead of being juvenilely insulted, this woman shared probably one of the worst things that could ever happen to anybody. And Ducey's just like, yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to totally ignore that.
Moving on.
Because the reason why I go out to the bar is to get in touch with real people and what their real concerns are. And then to just
not ideological right. extremists.
She wasn't ideologue.
That was a hard left position to be upset about your husband being murdered by the American insurance industry. That's super ideological. So
yep.
There's a little bit more of like a common sense, moderate American phobia about Guatemalans, as an example.
In my own defense, she didn't have the comment about being poor in America earlier. That's what threw me off. I didn't
know she was going to be quite so explicit the second time around.
Sort of gross.
It's
Anyways, back to you guys.
It's all flattened into equivalent bite-sized pieces of the spectacle.
What I want to know is what Kilmeade would have done, because Kilmeade is on such a contradictory road right now. He either would have been like,
oh,
he either would have been like, you can't blame the president for that, or he would have been like,
that's what he would have said. If he had insurance, he would have stayed alive, right?
Is
that what you're trying to argue? That's a little bit, I don't buy that.
But Obama said people could keep their doctors,
right? Well, that's yeah. Or with woke Kilmeade, which happens 10% now, he would have been like, yeah, and that's a real indictment of the private insurance industry, I think.
What?
I'm writing a book about
that. Did I say that?
Yeah.
All right,
but
we're going
to
take a quick
shout
break.
Shout out to the Democrats for realizing that not wanting to be murdered by the government is a winning idea that people have. You can run on it.
All right.
Testers coming through.
Oh, yes. Okay. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Dave Weigel. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program, the behest of the Central Intelligence Agency, national political correspondent.
Never gets old.
Never does. It doesn't. It actually, it's ongoing. The national political correspondent for the Washington Post, Dave Weigel. Now, Dave, before I brought you on, you said you were working on 3 hours of sleep. If it makes you feel any better, I'm almost right there with you.
Cool. I think we're both going to start babbling coherently the more we talk, so let's get to it.
Yes, let's do this. So you were in D.C. last night watching from the control center. Let's start. I mean, I've already top-lined some of the big, I guess, headlines from this. What was there anything that particularly surprised you that you saw out there?
I almost want to start with something that didn't surprise me, which was having been to a lot of these suburbs where Democrats were gaining, none of the House flips really shocked me. Even Max Rose in Staten Island is one that popped out to a lot of people last night. Having covered him, having covered Donovan was kind of like a sleepy, entitled incumbent. Rose was impressive, and there was a big Democratic advantage there that he turned out. So I'll start with the opposite of your answer. Now, that because the things that surprised me are the same things that surprised everybody else. Point I'm making everywhere today is that, look, Democrats got more votes for governor in Maryland really stands out, Ohio and Florida, than Republicans got when they won those races in 2014. And going into this, Democrats kind of had a mantra, a little bit of positive thinking, a little bit of data behind it, that if it was a high turnout election, they were going to win. And there are states where that's true, right? Virginia, that's true. Nevada, that's true. But that did not happen this time. I was surprised at the resilience of the Republican vote to come out for elections with fairly uninspiring candidates at the top of the ballot for them. That's not how Democrats behaved in the midterms in 10 and 14, you know, to their long-lasting political detriment.
So what do you think, I mean, what accounts for that? I mean, so just to be clear with what you're saying is that Democrats overperformed from their baselines. The problem is that Republicans overperform from their baselines, and maybe their baseline's a little bit higher, but they still overperform too. Like, we saw this in the special elections, it seems to me, that we had both parties overperforming the typical special election numbers, but it just so happened that Democrats overperformed just a little bit more. And in these instances, they didn't. I mean, what do you think accounts for that?
Well, so everyone's going to have the same take on this, which is that there's just been a resettling of people's base, of the political bases in this country. Sherrod Brown is a great example to watch here. Debbie Stabenow is a great example to watch, although very different races, where there are those maps in those states look like the Obama 2012 map, and the governor's race in Ohio, it looks like the Trump map. There's only one county in Ohio, I think the Turnbull County, that voted for Trump in 2016 and voted for Richard Cordray tonight. And this is despite Cordray running a much better campaign than Hillary Clinton, not having her vulnerabilities going into Election Day, very popular. So you have the sorting that you're seeing some kind of apocalyptic thinking today from people like Ian Millhiser at the Center for American Progress, saying if we're just heading into a period where, conservative voters will not vote for Democrats at any level for anything, it's hard to see how they ever win back the Senate. Republicans have had this sort of thinking before and been proven wrong and come back. But certainly there hasn't been hard Democratic thinking about how to compete, let's say, in Nebraska again. And the last time they achieved anything is when they could win Senate seats in Nebraska.
Right. I mean, so the idea being that these sort of tribal allegiances are hardening and the enthusiasm. I mean, we would have anticipated a lull in the enthusiasm in Republicans that we're not seeing. Is that a function of Donald Trump going up there and just, I mean, because the 2 days ago, everybody was saying there's a Trump tax. It costs you 4 points everywhere. I mean, is that the case? Is it different?
So
on a Senate level, yeah, on a House level, or in a governor's level? I mean, what? How do you sort that out?
It's very consistent, actually. So there's no state where Republicans, the exception of, you know, the blue states that have Republican moderate governors, there is no place where Republicans did better in this election than Trump did in 2016. They ran behind him in races they won, like in Indiana. They got about half of his margin. Tennessee, about half of his margin. In Missouri, about, you know, McCaskill's going to lose by 6 in a state that he won by 19. So if that tax, you know, carried out around the country, that does, you have a situation where it's hard for Republicans to win the House. And it is actually, the president, I think, starts 2020 as an underdog. You know, he's got a good economy, but he has an electoral map that looks a lot more like the one that reelected Barack Obama, you know, minus Ohio, more strength for Democrats in Virginia and Colorado. And then in the long term, you know, this Florida Amendment 4, which is going to lead to a couple hundred thousand people coming on the rolls as Democrats. So it's just because of the way the Senate map is structured. Let's say, you know, you picked up the Senate, made a chart, and just put half of it on the ballot this year. Probably the Republicans would have lost a couple seats.
Right.
They managed to pick up, we'll see at the end of the night, or the end of the week, what do they pick up? Maybe 4 seats in places that the president had won. So 4 of the 10 states the president had won, they gained. In the one Senate seat up this year where a Republican was up and Hillary had won, they lost.
Right.
And they lost despite leading in the polls. So that sorting, the word tribe gets used a lot. I'm not what to call it. Not sure what to call it. But look, where people were outnumbered in 2016, only in a couple cases did Republicans outperform, and that was just when they had moderate governors. Everywhere else, they ran behind it.
Okay, so, I mean, to boil it down on some level, there are some states that are very supportive of Trump, and in those states, mm-hmm. The Republicans did well. There are some states where he's not is supported, and the Republicans did poorly, and it just so happened, the luck of the draw, this cycle, and presumably, right, every 6 years from now, right, there's going to be more Democratic incumbents up for re-election. Well, I guess now it'll be Republicans too, because they picked up 4, but will be up for re-election then significantly more. It was like 2/3 more, right? Democrats were up for re-election. And so we were talking about this in 2015, even in anticipation of 2016. People were like, the 2018, the Democrats have to get the Senate in 2016, because in 2018, they're going to get wiped out. I mean, that was...
It was this very realistic conversation where I remember the stakes were, okay, well, if Hillary gets elected, she's got 2 years to do kind of anything at all, and then they're going to have 60 Senate seats. But at least she gets to appoint judges, et cetera, et cetera. That you bring that up, too, because I've been thinking right before the 2016 election, I was in Utah, and I talked to Jason Chaffetz, who at the time was going to continue leading the House Oversight Committee. And he was promising if they won, they were going to spend the 4 years, but the first 2 years investigating Hillary Clinton. And pretty honest about this. They were just going to have hearings because they said, okay, well, she wins by accident. We're going to beat her in 18 and 20. And Republicans are kind of that ruthless in public, and Democrats are not.
Yeah, and the Democrats aren't that ruthless in private either, it feels like.
No, actually, yeah, good point. In private, look, the way that Nancy Pelosi's talking about this, she's in kind of a strange position because she's under no illusions that she's popular.
Going on with that? Let's talk about the leadership.
She starts the aftermath. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I've seen some polling that she has just absurdly low favorability ratings outside of where she is. Now, Maybe it's not her fault, because again, she's been like one of those like 20-year Republican projects to, you know, San Francisco values. Mm-hmm. She's losing support on the left, it seems to me, as well, within mm-hmm. the Democratic Party. So that may account for some of it too. But what is she thinking? Is she thinking that she's going to run for re-election in 2 years, that she wants to be leader of the, you know, Speaker of the House when maybe the Democrats take back the Senate? I mean, what's the, like, why? Why is she doing this? Is she waiting for somebody to come to come up from below and letting them get a little more seasoning? Because it doesn't seem like there's any youth coming into the leadership at all.
No, I mean, what in my more cruel moments, I refer to the House Democrat leadership as like the gambler who stays at the table trying to break even.
Right.
You know, just need to get back to even, then I can go home from the casino. Because you've got a leadership team that's been there literally for a decade, has lost before tonight, had lost four elections in a row, and you know, gained a couple seats in two of them, but was out of power, and they just are not budging. Even today, they're giving signals they're not going to budge. And so it's getting a little bit in the weeds, but Pelosi's public strategy here has been to unwind the negative impressions about her by kind of being herself, you know, going on the Colbert Report, talking about bipartisanship. She does think she
that's
can have
very much herself
as far as any human can.
Being
it is. And it is. But they just made this bet to know, you know, kind of a classic baby boomer behavior.
Right.
No, we don't trust anyone else to do this for us, so we're just going to lock ourselves in here, and because the next generation wouldn't do as good a job as us. And you've seen some blanching to that, like this class that's coming in. So we need to do, once everything's called, we'll do the math on how many people said they wouldn't vote for her for speaker. Beyond that, you have some young talent that's been trying to move up. And the way she was framing her decision leading into this election was, I'm going to be a transitional speaker. So what does that mean? I don't know. The way that a lot of people interpreted it was, she's going to be speaker through the end of this Trump term. And then does she say no one else is good to me, I need to keep running this? I mean, she's going to turn 80 in 2020 in the next couple of years. So if she's serious about the transition, you might see some more hints at that. But she's also said she doesn't want to be seen as a lame duck. So I don't know what that means. Like, the more I describe it, the more confused I get about what her plan is.
And to be clear, I'm not as concerned about her age as I am her political tenure, which, months ago she was talking about instituting PAYGO last night. Let's play one of these clips. I don't know which one is more ridiculous from her speech last night. I'm sure you heard this. Is this the one where she's talking about the bipartisan marketplace of ideas? I mean, let's just hear this clip.
Stark contrast to the GOP Congress, a Democratic Congress will be led with transparency and openness, so that the public can see what's happening and how it affects them, and that they can weigh in with the members of Congress and with the President of the United States. We will have accountability, and we will strive for bipartisanship with fairness on all sides. We will have a responsibility to find our common ground where we can, stand our ground where we can't, but we must try. We have a bipartisan marketplace of ideas that makes our democracy strong. A Democratic Congress will work for solutions.
All right, Dave, just talk me down here. Is that just like pablum that they feel like, oh, we have to do this because we've always done it since, you know, the 90s?
Everybody talks like this. I mean, Barack Obama talked like this. Trump talked like this for like 10 seconds after the 2016 election. Ryan talked like this. Although Ryan, got into much more how we're going to bring back regular order, which no Republican cares about when they have power, or no, and few Democrats. I think in Pelosi's case, she does believe this. She does believe that when she ran the House, especially in 2007, she was fair. She, you know, she helped pass TARP. She took some hits when she needed to. She passed Democratic bills. She, this is just a different theory of politics than Republicans have. She wants there to pass progressive legislation, but not in a way that blows everything up. And I think she really, the way things turned out in 2010, I don't think she ever got over it, where she thought she did pass compromises, keep people safe from tough votes if they needed to, and got wiped out and got demonized. So I think she this is what I keep getting back to, where Democrats making this this bet that they could keep her on as leader. They never really had this conversation about, well, what if we had a new leader who leads on a clear agenda, starts fresh with the public? They never really did that. They kind of let every candidate run their own campaign. And so the result of that is having Pelosi with this sort of, you said pablum, this sort of boilerplate about bipartisanship.
But if 2010 stung, what did she learn from it? It doesn't feel like she learned anything.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
this is the same thing with Obama and Biden. When I would hear them on the trail, they would describe like how we need to get back to a certain level of civility. And if you're beyond, you know, if you're on left-wing Twitter, then this is obvious. But if you're any kind of Democrat, you think, well, gee, like Republicans changed the rules and, you know, stole a Supreme Court nomination, all the things you go over the way that Republicans kind of smash the rule book to gain power. You look at that and you think, why do we keep acting nice? But I would say the first press conference, the first statements after an election by the party that wins are not like legally binding.
Right.
I don't think.
I mean, I know that.
I think she does what she wants to set this tone, but I'm not sure if that's how she's going to. So the thing to watch here to move it forward a little bit is that Republicans are kind of are pre-gaming almost and saying, well, in a very kind of Brer Rabbit way, well, all right, well, these guys won, but it's really going to backfire if they do any investigations of Trump. They can't do that. And that's just no Democrat falls for that. But they definitely need to be making the assertive argument. And frankly, they won the election with that argument. I mean, I was in as many congressional districts as anybody. If voters were worried that a Democratic Congress would probe the president and ask for, you know, Mar-a-Lago contract records, all that stuff, they would have not voted for Democrats. It was pretty clear that Democrats were going to investigate the guy. If you want to be cheeky about it, look, the closing ads that Republicans ran were warning that if you elect Democrats, they're going to impeach the president and bring single-payer health care about. Okay, well, having won,
right?
Maybe you don't do all that. But you won with voters being told, hey, elect these guys, they're going to be unfair to the president. For you to then go ahead and say, hey, how about you release the same level of transparency that every president in history has done up to now? It doesn't seem wild-eyed to me, and it doesn't seem like it lost voters.
Yeah, I mean, that is promises made, promises kept, right? I mean, if
I think so.
All right, well, so let me ask you a couple of questions that struck me as sort of bizarre. How is it, and my understanding is that the gap with Gillum is still closing, and we had somebody call in last night who said that the new Florida licenses that were issued apparently did not scan by the voting machines, you know, when they signed
awesome.
In to vote.
Cool. Good and, democracy.
And
yeah.
that all those people were given provisional ballots. Because of some screw up with the 3D imprint on the Florida licenses. Now, I haven't confirmed that.
Florida gonna Florida.
But if it's the case that there are a lot of provisional ballots and Gillum, you know, counts, maybe, I don't know, maybe it becomes closer. Maybe we'll see. But how do you reconcile the idea that Amendment 4, which re-enfranchises 1.5 million felons, overwhelmingly passed in Florida, but DeSantis looks like he won. How do you square those two things?
I'm not sure that came across. That was just kind of like a sigh. Provisional ballots are important. They do flip elections sometimes. Democrats at this point, especially in a race in races like states like Georgia rather and Florida, are pretty good now at chasing people who had election day problems and if they had provisional ballots going after them. So that is why I think you have not seen a call in the Florida Senate race, for example. That's why there's a couple of races I think they're not going to be resolved for weeks. And you know, if this is something that I think Democrats, you're going to have a discussion from some of the House Democrats about introducing a bill that would not pass, but would bring national attention to voting reform to solve this problem. Because look, Brian Kemp might end up winning this election after running it pretty badly. The two issues that I think Democrats have begun to highlight as kind of good government issues are voter integrity and gerrymandering. And on both of those, when gerrymandering was on the ballot this year, it got completely wiped out. You know, in Missouri, in Michigan, we're waiting on Utah, but in at least two states, people voted against gerrymandering. I think there's probably a electoral majority for how about we don't make people stand in line for 5 hours? How about we don't screw up the voting machines, et cetera. But Democrats have not, you know, the last time they had power, they didn't do a ton on that issue. And I think they've gotten scared straight since then.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. So I had two questions. I had two questions that were rolled in there. One was just sort of leading in about maybe the chance that Gill may picked up. But how do you square the Fourth Amendment in Florida winning, or I should say Amendment 4 or whatever, I can't remember what, winning so easily? And Gillum losing, like, how do you, does that make sense to you? Can you explain that?
I can very easily. So this is like a great little game theory question, because on the one hand, the stakes were very high to win the governor's race in Florida. On the other hand, the stakes were high maybe for, you know, generations to get this amendment passed. And in Florida, you need 60% of the vote to pass a constitutional amendment. So there was a decision made by the people behind that amendment not to make it super partisan. Now, Andrew Gillum was for it. Ron DeSantis was against it. I believe Rick Scott was against it. Certainly, Rick Scott probably personally denied enough felons' rights to get him the lead he has right now. But they kind of kept Republican big money on the sidelines by not turning this into a partisan cause. And the people behind Amendment 4 very, very cleverly got, you know, Coke money, some Republican criminal justice reform money. They kept them on board with this as a, we can all agree on this, good government reform. And so they didn't yoke the Democrats to that. And had they, it's hard to say what would have happened. So in Ohio, you had a ballot measure that failed on criminal justice reform, and the statewide Democratic ticket failed. In Florida, all you needed was this thing to get 59% of the vote, and you would have lost your best chance, perhaps ever, to change that law. So I think it was a strategic decision. And, you know, but for 100,000 votes in Florida, we're not even asking about it.
I mean,
we're saying, oh, it was brilliant of them to do this.
That's amazing, right? I mean, because it also suggests that, like, when you do have races, you know, these special elections, when all the Democrats pour in their national money, that may be counterproductive, because you are sort of like triggering, you know, like everybody, like it's like the electorate now has this sort of latent virus that can be triggered by environmental changes. And once the environment changes, they turn into, you know, everything becomes super tribal.
No, it's not just that, but imagine if the president had just tweeted at the start of early voting, I don't know, let me get in the Trump voice here, Florida Amendment 4 is a disgrace, would bring criminals to our streets, vote against it for the troops, you know, something like that.
Right.
If the president had, like, used his campaign megaphone to say vote against this, and that had flipped, you know, 200,000 votes, that would have been the ball game. So they had to be very careful about this. And that's just a quirk of the way Florida amends its constitution, which to me is not the craziest idea. I think getting 60% of the votes probably good. I mean, North Carolina passed a couple of bad amendments now with 55% of the vote. So that was just the way that they decided to build the campaign around this.
And how do you explain, let's say, like Ohio, you know, Cordray losing in Ohio, but Walker, you know, losing in Wisconsin, or Whitmore winning in Michigan? Why does Trump have salience in one place and not the other?
Yeah, that's a really, so basically the question is, it's very cultural. And so exit polls aren't everything, but if there's Appalachia in your state, Trump was very resilient. And if there wasn't, he was not. So let's look at, you know, Ohio has always been more conservative than Michigan. In Ohio on election day, especially in Southwest Ohio, Southeast Ohio, I say, the voters who were Democrats until Trump came around, were very positive toward the president. In Ohio, you know, 7% of people who had not voted in the midterm, sorry, by a 7-point margin, people who never voted in the midterm before voted Republican. They were Trump people who were convinced to come back out. Wow. And then in the upper Midwest, you just have kind of a different political and cultural tradition. And there you see first time midterm voters broke for Democrats. White voters broke for, not broke for Democrats. I mean, the white vote in Michigan was like Democrats lost it by about 5-6 points. But it in West Virginia and Tennessee, in Kentucky, you have a cultural break from the Democratic Party that I don't think they have any plan to repair. I mean, like, honestly, I thought the best repair plan was the Richard Ojeda campaign, which did about as good as you can imagine any campaign doing in that state at this time, and that wasn't enough. So
right.
I don't think they have an answer. It's just the same thing. If you're asking Republicans, hey, so what's your plan to go back and win, Fairfax County, Virginia? I mean, they don't have one. Those voters culturally have broken away, and maybe they'll vote for some future governor who runs as a moderate, but they're not going to vote. They're not going to vote for a Trump Republican Party, just as the Ashtabula County Democratic voter is gone, and they're not going to vote for any Democrat except Sherrod Brown.
So where's the best place for Democrats to fish? If we're talking about West Virginia,
yeah,
and anything that touches Appalachia is like, don't bother, really, right? I mean, unless you're willing to be Joe Manchin.
Yeah.
I mean, Joe Manchin outperformed, other Democrats by what, like 50 points, right? I mean, his state went for, we're talking about West Virginia, Joe Manchin's state went 45 at least points for Trump, and he won his race by 5 points. That's a 50-point swing. And Joe Manchin, from the perspective of most Democrats, other than the fact that he has a D and 65% of the time you get him to vote with Democrats, he's a louse. But so where can Democrats win without having to be louses?
Most of the country is the answer. On this map, I'm saying most of the country when it comes to, I'm probably repeating myself, point earlier, but there in Michigan, in basically the states that make up like a Obama 2012 electoral majority, they can pull that off. And they can't in places where just they used to have populist Democrats and they don't anymore. Step back a few paces. Democrats decided in this cycle not to have a conversation where they kind of elevated pro-life Democrats. And they could have won some primaries if they wanted to. I mean, Colin Peterson's like the last of these guys, Minnesota. He won his primary, he won his election. He's safe. He's sticking around. You didn't see what Republicans thought they were going to see, which was like this policing of only nominating the most left-wing candidates, but they did not nominate, the kind of Democrats who used to win in these states, which involves breaking with the party. And I frankly think the kind of purity test folks who are angry at Manchin and wish he would, there were people chanting at Manchin during the Kavanaugh vote for him to switch parties. You just can't get away with that. You could, you know, overthrow the government, write a new constitution so that we have proportional representation or a parliament like a normal country. But as long as you have every state getting two senators, they don't have a plan to fix this.
Right. Dave Weigel, anything that we left unsaid, do you think? Or are you just so desperate to take a nap there that there's nothing?
I'm going to say it. It all came down to Waukesha County. And it all came down to how Scott Walker could not deliver his usual vote for Waukesha County. That was the election.
My understanding is he needed 70% there. What did he get?
In the mid-60s, and that was when they knew he was cooked. God bless that little county. It's never done us wrong, except for the many, many times when it's done us wrong.
We had Josh Orton on the program yesterday. He said if Walker doesn't break 70 there, he loses. There you go.
Yep. That's the suburbs. That is the Trump effect. And hey, the final thing to run on or to leave on. This is an election where the party in power could brag about 3.7% unemployment. What does this election look like if they can't? I don't know. That's something that needs to be litigated. But this president has never had to face an election they're not going rosy for him economically. Not that I'm wishing that for the country, but there's a lot of scenarios we've never seen yet. The one we did where Democrats are trying to convince voters, hey, the economy's great, but vote for us. You know what? It actually mostly worked for them.
That's true. Good point. And if the steam runs out of the Obama economy, Donald Trump may have some explaining to do. Dave Weigel, Washington Post, thanks so much for your time today, buddy. I really appreciate it. I know you're exhausted.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I'll talk to you anytime.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half. Wherein we will take your phone calls. Obviously, results are still going to come, but let's leave on this. You know, Scott Walker had a when he found out that he lost. I guess this morning, he posted this on his Twitter feed. This is the day that the Lord has made. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. And I guess that's Psalm 118:24. Four, if I remember correctly, off the top of my head.
Yeah, good memory.
Thank you. And so
that's how I cheer myself up too. I look at pictures of sort of like highly edited sunsets and put some psalms over it, and that's what I did last night after I got home. Actually,
I wonder if that's the Great Lake or an ocean, like because he's in Wisconsin. He probably doesn't spend a lot of time at in the ocean. He can now. So, Scott Walker, I am sure you will go off and get a job with Koch Industries and continue doing horrible things.
He's going to mop up at Foxconn.
There you go. Exactly. Or maybe he'll get a job with Foxconn. Offers him $5 billion worth of state money and then walks across the street and starts collecting on it.
It's a perfectly viable gulag option for Scott Walker.
There you go.
A Foxconn job. If all Foxconn jobs were former politicians, I'd be cool with it.
What do you think his Foxconn job would be? My guess is it would be...
Lobbyist for Foxconn.
I feel like he would be positioned in the no-show wing of the warehouse, where he just got to send an assistant down there once a week to press a punch card, and they just send him a big check. That's called a kickback, and he certainly earned it. In terms of what he gave them.
Yep.
Scott Walker, bye-bye. All right. And
walk away, Scott, walk away
walk
from
away.
The governorship.
Walk
away.
Where
is Dave Rubin and his walk away movie? Oh, can we play this walk away thing? Yeah, let's.
It's kind of long, though.
It's kind of long, but you know what, folks? This is pretty cheery. I think you're going to enjoy this. The great Vic Berger. Now, you all recall... several months ago, we played a video. What was the name of that guy who was running the walk away campaign? He was some New York like model. Not like
that
a,
guy.
Not a hugely successful model, I don't think. Who was announcing to the world that he had been a Democrat. Now he was going to walk away. Here it is. It's the walk away march. What was the name of the guy?
The poor man's Milo.
The poor man's Milo. But he I can't remember what. Let's see. He had a lot of. He was going to have Dinesh D'Souza was going to be there. Can't you do the a contact maybe or who was the Prescott? Yeah, his name's all over it. I bet. Let's see what we got in that.
Does
Prescott.
It matter what his name is?
Why well, are we so worried about
the fact that we can't remember
him?
It shows that he's failed.
Brandon Straka.
Yeah.
Okay. No, that's why. That's a funny name.
Yeah, it's a funny name. So Brandon Straka had this walk away movement, and you'll recall Dave Rubin. I mean, go back into Dave Rubin's tweets. I don't have the time for this. Like 3 or 4 months ago, and he was. It was as if Dave Rubin was like on a rolling ayahuasca trip or something like that, because he was like, hey, I woke up this morning and I had visions of people walking away from the Democratic Party, and we're on the verge of something really huge, and African-Americans are about to abandon, because Dave is so in touch with what the African-American zeitgeist is, and they're all going to walk away.
Larry Elder told me.
Yeah, we're all walking away. Many people have asked me, and here's... Then he talks about walk away, and then Dave Rubin canceled his appearance at the walk away thing. Never addressed it. And here is Brandon Straka's walk away. They were going to get millions, or at the very least hundreds of thousands, or at the very least tens of thousands, or at the very least thousands, or at the very least hundreds, or at the very least tens, and they delivered on those tens of people. And here is Vic Berger's reinterpretation of the videos that came from there. It's a little bit long, but you deserve this, folks. Enjoy it. Democrats took the House. What happens next is going to be a combination of oversight and all hell breaking loose, I believe, in the lame duck session. But here is that walk away march.
All right, everybody, keep walking. Walk, walk, walk. Again, if you're going to be part of the walk, you need to walk now. Just want to make sure everybody keeps moving. Now is the time to walk if you're walking. If you're going to walk, you want to go now. Just want to make sure everybody keeps moving. If you're going to walk, you need to go now.
Hey! Hey! I heard a song when I was walking up here called Lock Her Up. Lock Her Up. And you know, I started dancing when I heard it. They said, lock her up, lock her up, lock her up. Hey! Yes.
I was
at the White House yesterday.
Pause it for 1 second.
That guy's awesome.
Just want to remind you, these are all former Democrats who were singing Lock Her Up. And then they realized they were... They were going to get off the Democratic plantation.
How great would it be if Obama showed up?
That's it.
Well, lock her up. Lock her up.
That's why they all walked away, was because they wanted to join in the cheer. Go ahead.
My fellow superhero Kanye made the shirt.
I was at the White House yesterday. It was a pleasure to be there to see Donald Trump in person. At the White House. I love you, too. So... Say USA, 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 USA. I love you too. Walk away, walk away, walk away. I love you, America. Thank you.
This guy's career did not go the way he wanted it to go.
Hey,
that's
we're
so
about
sad.
To hear some more music. And I hate to do this because we're so upbeat, but I'm reading that there was a horrible shooting in Pittsburgh at a synagogue, and 8 people have been killed. Hey, JT, make everyone happy.
You guys inspired today or what?
The reason I'm here today is because I wrote a song for our movement.
I wish we could play that.
Somehow, by the grace of God, it went viral. I got a show on Patriot Soapbox on Sunday nights, you guys, 9 o'clock. Come check me out. I am JT Wild.
Take your time, dude.
Woo! This is awesome. Ha! Ha! Woo! Ha! Woo! Woo! Ha! Ha! Woo! Michael Flynn Jr.'s here. I want to dedicate this song to his dad. Don't you cry, cause I'll be coming home to you.
Hey, look here, we got a saying in the biker world. If I had never...
Thank you, guys. That's called Arm Yourselves.
I wish I had the ability to award the Academy Award.
That's my preferred film way to take in reality.
That is...
also sassy
Kurt
Trump.
Berger, such a genius.
That's so good.
All right, folks, enjoy. We're going to take a quick break, head into the fun half. Don't forget, you can support this show by becoming a member. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. You support our daily show, shows like we had last night. We're going to have debate shows, I would imagine, coming up in the next 2 years. We're going to have a coverage of maybe hearings. Let's hope we're not covering any more Supreme Court hearings.
Press conference is wild right now.
Oh yeah.
And
all right. Well, we'll cut to it after the break. All right. Don't forget TMBS. You can go to patreon.com/TMBS and the Antifada. Patreon.com/TheAntifada, and of course the Literary Hangover at patreon.com/LiteraryHangover. All right, folks. See you in the and don't forget Michael's live show. You can check it out on the homepage. It's in February. Buy tickets now. Tickets almost going to run out. All right. See you in the fun half. 646-257-3920.
It's a nice feeling. It's real.
W-U-L.
It's a nice feeling. Sweetheart, get me a beer. I totally get it. They are. You turn on the TV, some iteration of me. Zero sum game. It's a nice feeling. Zero sum game. Zero sum game. It's a nice feeling. You're gonna lose your status. He's the king of his zero sum game. I totally get it. Zero sum game. They are. Zero sum game. Sweetheart. Get me a beer. Get me a beer.